course, in the last few months, we've been looking pretty much at apologetical theory, general principles that pertain to the defense of the faith, and I have taken the last three sessions, as I recall, maybe four, to contrast two specific approaches to apologetics in our day and age that have been popular, one called evidentialism, the other called presuppositionalism. And we're done with all that theoretical talk now. I think it's very important, but I also know that students tend to be a little more enthusiastic about getting down to the nitty-gritty of hearing the arguments and the answers and strategies and that sort of thing. And this is what we begin to do tonight. I want to start looking at some of the major problems that people have, that they raise against Christianity, and the way in which we as Christians should be able to respond to them. And as you know from my introductory discussions, I'm going to favor what is called a presuppositional approach to answering these people. So, what subject should we start with first? My personality, I don't know, my training, whatever, I tend to be oriented to work from the general to the particular. We look for the broadest principles, the most general things that come to bear on a subject, and then work down to the idiosyncratic differences between things. And so as I look out at the world today, the social setting in which we live, I think that one of the major problems that we as defenders of the Christian faith face is relativism. More than anything else, what I hear from people in answer to the defense that I give them or the witness that I give them, the evangelistic appeal that I give them, what I hear more than anything else is the idea, well, that may be true for you, but it's not for me. You do occasionally run into people who have arguments about, well, how can there be a God if there's evil in this world? Okay, it's called the problem of evil. And that's something we will look at and probably take a couple of sessions on. There are some people who have a specific objection like that. There are some people who say, well, I don't believe in miracles, so I couldn't believe in the Bible specifically. But I bet if you stop and think about it, you don't run into many like that. I think that's interesting. If we do an actual, not a textbook analysis, but if you just look at your own experience, what people tell you when you try to witness to them or they're responding negatively to your Christian faith, as they know it, more than anything else, not sold, but more than anything else, I'll bet you hear relativism. Because we have come in our culture, which is really a degenerate thing, to be sure, and Francis Schaeffer has reflected on this very well in many of his writings. In our culture, we've come to associate religion with irrationality, mysticism, things that go beyond scientific precision and truth. Religion is in the area of the subjective. And as we know, in the area of the subjective, it's different strokes for different folks. It's like art. Art is subjective. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And religion is like that. So, I mean, if you see Christianity as beautiful, well, that's beauty in your eye, and that's fine for you. But I may find beauty in Hinduism, or I may find beauty in naturalism, or I may find beauty in humanism. And so, relativism, I think, is the pervasive enemy of the Christian faith in our day. And that's what I want to take up for our discussion tonight. In Aristotle's book, The Nicomachean Ethic, which is one of the most important books written in the ancient world dealing with ethics, Aristotle makes this observation. Let me quote him. He says, "Fire burns both in Hellas and in Persia, but men's ideas of right and wrong vary from place to place." Fire burns in both places. You deal with some kind of objective, concrete, physical reality like fire, no problem. It's the same in Hellas as in Persia. But when you want to talk about right and wrong, you'll find that men's ideas are not the same in Hellas and in Persia. And you can go on and on, right? Every society you move to. This is the underlying insight or observation that the relativist makes. And I want to begin, maybe surprisingly to you, by agreeing with what I think motivates relativism, agreeing with the observation that the society in which we live, the context, circumstances, or environment in which we are brought up, does indeed bear in a very heavy fashion, in a determining way, upon our beliefs. What we believe is very much a reflection of our environment. I don't think we can get away from that. That is an accurate observation about human psychology and society. The relativist, you see, is pointing out the importance of social environment in determining the content of our beliefs about what is the case and also about what ought to be the case. That the social environment has a determining influence on what we believe about things. And then add to that, which is another accurate observation, that societies tend to differ from one another. There's a great deal of diversity between social environments. Now put those two things together, and what that suggests then is what you believe about what is the case, what exists, what is real, and what you believe about what we ought to do in this world is pretty much going to be determined by the society in which you live. Since societies differ, then beliefs about these things differ. So I agree with that. I think that's an accurate observation. It's basically called the sociology of knowledge. The sociology, the social impact upon our knowledge structures, our beliefs, our values. But I think that's as far as relativism goes in being helpful. You see, people will go beyond that and say things like, and therefore there is no objective reality. There is no objective truth. Now what do I mean by the word objective over against the word subjective? To deny that there's an objective truth is to deny that there's anything which is the same for all people and it's publicly accessible. It's not like an object. But instead, truth is subjective or subject-oriented. The subject is the person who's doing the thinking or experiencing or talking or seeing or what have you. And truth then becomes subjective, meaning person-relative, dependent upon the individual who's doing the thinking or experiencing. It is not objective. Aristotle says fire burns in both these places. That's objective. It won't make a difference what you believe about it. It's going to burn your hand no matter where you are. But when it comes to other things like religion or ethics, then it seems like there isn't anything objective about it. It doesn't have an out there-ness about it. It's always changing, always moving, always fluctuating. And so the relativist goes beyond this to say, therefore there is no objective truth, no one can know anything for certain, and, or, the relativist will say, there is no absolute right and wrong. Let's look at the term absolute. We've been talking about objective. What do we mean by absolute? When something is absolute, we mean it is unqualified. Mathematicians among us will recognize that right away. The concept of an absolute number, one that's not qualified by it being positive or negative, right? Bad example. Wrong group to use that. Okay. Forget absolute numbers. Okay. There are other things which are absolute. Okay? Your mother tells you that you are to be in by 11 o'clock. She means it absolutely. In that sentence, the word absolute means no excuses, no qualifications, right? No exceptions. Absolutely, you begin by 11 o'clock. The relativist says there is no absolute value. There is no value that is unqualified. All values are relative to the person who believes it or the society in which that person comes to believe it. Everything differs from society to society. Can somebody suggest to me what it is particularly, what field of study it was in particular in our country, which really made cultural relativism in ethics, a popular thing in American university studies. What department was it that just kind of, I mean, this just broke open after the turn of the century, 1910 to 1925 especially? Jim, you want to make a guess?
Sociology,
absolutely right. Because what do sociologists study? They study societies. I mean, you study societies, lo and behold, now this wasn't so much, it was really in the late 30s, early 40s that we began to get into the studies of Samoan cultures and the island people, that sort of thing. That really revolutionized things. But it was way back in the first decade of this century that Herskovitz and Sumner at Yale and Harvard were promoting ideas about folkways and cultural relativism based on what we are coming to know about different cultures. And what they were suggesting is there is no absolute right and wrong that transcends one particular country or subgroup within a country. There is no absolute right and wrong that moves, that stays the same from place to place to place, from time to time to time, that everything is conditioned by time and place when it comes to morals. That's what sociology has taught us. And so we have the idea that no objective truth can be found and the notion that there are no absolute moral standards as the formal expression of relativism. And my guess is your milkman will not put it that way. The milkman, who is a relativist, will not likely even know what the title of his theory or his outlook is. You know, if he were to say something to you that smacked of relativism, and you said, "Oh, I see you're a relativist," he'd say, "Don't swear at me," and he'll let him call me names. So we've been a little academic about this. I think it's important to do that because, frankly, if you see it in its what I'll call hot house environment, it's more pure and properly developed form, it will actually turn out to be easier to deal with it in its garden variety expressions we see in the give and take of life with people. I want you to help. I want you to give me some illustrations. How do you see relativism in your experience? How does this come to expression in your interaction with people or what you see in our culture around about you? Okay. That's right. If you have a real definite point of view and somebody says, yeah, but it's important to be open-minded, meaning what? No one can know for sure, right? Everyone has got to be, you have to be willing to grant that there are other ways to see things. How's that? Okay, and then if they're approached and they're told the procedure is this, but you haven't done that, the response is?
I've heard that half a dozen rationalizations.
What's not important to me? Everyone else is doing it. All of these are expressions of relativism. What else?
Situation ethics,
exactly. That's real popular today. The idea that what love dictates is determined by the situation, not by some previous absolute. And Joseph Fletcher, in fact, made a mint teaching this, you know, with theological trappings about it, but nevertheless promoting the idea that the only thing that God calls us to do is to be loving. And what love dictates cannot be determined in advance of the situation. You just have to look at the situation itself. And if that's the case, then obviously no preacher can stand up in the pulpit and say, "Thus saith the Lord, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not lie." Because there are always situations where you should steal, where you should commit adultery, where you should lie. In fact, Fletcher is so bold as to say that may be the expression of love in your situation. Commit adultery, or to steal, or to lie, or to kill, whatever it may be. So situation ethics. How do you see relativism on TV?
Mm-hmm.
The real question is, how do you not see relativism on TV? Where can you turn? Situation comedies, okay, which may be waning a little bit, I guess, in popularity, but nevertheless, they've really dominated the screen for over a decade. Situation comedies, especially the ones that have been promoted by Norman Lear, I think make it almost a vicious point to promote relativism. And no one knows for sure. And anybody who is portrayed on TV in the comedies and elsewhere as having very set and traditional oriented views, someone who is real absolutistic in his or her approach, there's always a setup for what? Ridicule, embarrassment, hypocrisy, on and on and on. That's always something to be put down, not something to be applauded. Well, what about the live and let live attitude that we see not only on TV, but all around us people? Well, you've got your religion, you've got your ideas, you've got your ethic, your lifestyle, but I've got mine. And doesn't democracy demand this? Democracy requires us to be relativists. I've actually had people tell me that. You know, we have no right to say we're the only ones who are correct because we live in a democratic society. For the life of me, I can't figure out that reasoning. I mean, I can figure out the fallacy that's involved, but I can't see how anybody could be persuaded by that. It may be true that I have no right to silence you in a democracy. I think that point might be made even, though I don't agree with it entirely either. But to say, since everyone has his right to believe what he wants, therefore everyone can be as correct as the other guy, is a huge leap in reasoning, isn't it? But nevertheless, that's a popular expression. Live and let live. Think of any others? It's not always the word complex that is used, but that is exactly the underlying idea, that the issue is so big, so beyond our ability to grasp, that nobody has the right to think they had finally come to a conclusion that takes care of all the details. That, too, is a form of relativism. No one can know for sure. Of course, I know for sure that you are wrong, but no one knows for sure. Bob? Yes, that's a good illustration. The using of terms like fanatic for anybody who just, you know, is holding firm to some opinion or some view, you know, don't be so fanatical, you know, be so stressed out about things. Yeah?
I was thinking, just pertaining to religions, too, it's just, you know, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witness, anything, just leave them alone, you know, different people want to
be too. Yeah. It's interesting to me to see the response you get. I think many of you will associate with this. I have an experience where in my wife's side of the family, we have some who are believers and the majority who are not. And so when we get together like at Christmas or Thanksgiving and so forth, sometimes get into discussions. It's interesting. If I say something against the Roman Catholics or against the Mormons, not personal, you know, some kind of a slight against them as individuals, but against their theology or their belief or their practice, what have you. I get that sort of response from people, you know, these are good people. I mean, I have next door neighbors that are Mormons, so who are you, you know, to say X, Y, Z about their beliefs or whether they're right or wrong, sort of thing. Everybody is basically good. In fact, there are some, like Gordon Stein, fellow I debated, who doesn't think there's any value, I guess, in religion. But for the most part, even people who aren't Christian believers will say, well, yeah, religion's got its place. There is some value to religion, but nobody can know for sure. So every religion is right in its own way. We have in the field of comparative religion a very popular metaphor that is used, of Mount Fuji, or mountain, I guess. The idea that this mountain has many roads that are going up the mountain. You know, and every road leads to the top. And so you have Buddhism, and you have Shintoism, and you have Zoroastrianism, and Taoism, and Christianity. And they really are all accomplishing the same thing. They're all different roads that are going up the same mountain of religion. They all have some idea of the beyond, something that is outside of man, somehow important to them. And so religious relativism. And try crossing religious relativism in our day and age, and you'll offend people. I mean, I think you should offend them, by the way, but they will find that troublesome, arguably. Okay, you see relativism all around you. Now, what can we say, then, in answer to relativism? What happens when you've spent 4 or 5 sessions, or 4 or 5 hours, or 4 or 5 minutes, for that matter, witnessing to somebody and giving them reasons to believe in Jesus Christ and to repent of their sins and so forth, and then they say something like, "Well, you know, I'm really glad to see you're happy. I think that's great for you, but I don't know, it's just not for me. Just not for me. You know, I think that's true for you. It is true for you that Jesus is Lord, but I just haven't found it to be true in my life. So I'm going to have to, you know, catch you later on." You know how frustrating, I mean, I can see the looks on your face. That's frustrating, isn't it? You hate it when people do that. You say, wait a minute, that isn't right. Okay, now how can you effectively deal with that? What's that? Chicken in the shin? Bob? Yeah, Bob, what if someone were to reply to you, though? Yeah, in our culture, you and I have been brought up in a similar enough way that you and I would both call that a hedge, but that's not important because we both live in this culture. However, in another culture, what you call the heads might be called the tails. They might also respond, well, yeah, when it comes to such easy objective matters as whether fire burns in Hellas and fire burns in Persia, of course. But when it comes to things you can't touch and see, things you that are internal, morality, theology, what have you, then it is different stroke for different folks. Well, that's true for you.
But it has to be true for everybody
who doesn't make sense. No, it makes sense for you, but it doesn't make sense for me. No, keep going. Because this is exactly what you're going to run into. How do you deal with this? It's very frustrating. Can I make a suggestion at this juncture? I would suggest that instead of immediately throwing down the gauntlet and saying, now listen, you rascal, this is wrong, and you can't think like this, and we're wrong. I mean, that's the very sort of thing relatives don't like, right? I mean, not that you're not going to get there. I'm not accommodating myself to the relativism. But in terms of style, I'm going to suggest that you might ask a question for clarification. Always a good approach, no? Let me understand what you're saying. Are you saying that I believe in Jesus? I believe that he rose from the dead, that I believe in God and the Trinity and salvation and afterlife, and so, that I believe these things, but that you don't believe them. You see, the person has said, it's true for you, but it's not true for me. And when he says that, you say, wait a minute, I just want to understand what you're saying. Are you saying then simply that I believe it, but you don't believe it, or are you trying to say something more than that? You know, you'll find it. It's very interesting. A lot of people get stuck right there because for the first time in their life, whether they're your milkman or your philosophy professor, they may realize there's a difference between saying that truth is relative and beliefs are relative. I believe that beliefs are relative. It's part of the fun. I do think that beliefs are different from people to people. But you see, there's nothing really profound about that. Really kind of trivial. I also believe that people are, in many of their beliefs, mistaken. Okay, so now after you've made that kind of observation, then you see how you've opened the door, because what you want to come back to say is, and so, you have a belief, and I have a belief, and I think yours is mistaken, and you think mine is mistaken. Now let's see if we can deal with that. Let's not cut short the conversation, let's not cut short the debate, or cut short our discussion, by simply observing what should be obvious from the outset, that we have different beliefs. Yeah, we have different beliefs. So what? One of us is right, one of us is wrong, or conceivably both of us are wrong. Now, do you see what I'm getting at here? You need to point out to people that relativism is fine. And this is where it gets its strength, because this is what I think people are saying, and then they make more of it than it's really there to be made of. They're saying, we have different beliefs. We don't see things the same way. Absolutely right, you don't. However, I think you see things wrong. I think the way you're looking at things is mistaken. That's what you have to deal with. It actually does not make philosophical sense to say that truth is person relative. It makes perfectly good sense to say beliefs are person relative. What you believe to be true is governed by your feelings, your setting, your experiences, observations, what have you. But to say that what is actually true is person relative, and this is where Bob gave the example of the coin, or I often use the example of whether one's car is parked outside or not. Those sorts of things, you can say, I believe it's parked outside, you don't believe it's parked outside, one of us is right, one of us is wrong. But to say that it's true that for me it's parked outside, but for you it's not parked outside, doesn't make the slightest bit of sense. Truth is not relative, but beliefs are. And you see, by creating that juncture, what happens, you see, in terms of the psychological process, by making the person now decide, am I affirming relativism of belief or relativism of truth, what I'm hoping is, in many of your encounters, people will see, well, the only sensible thing to say is, well, we have different beliefs. And once they've said that, you're right back on track, apologetically, aren't you? See, they haven't escaped. They haven't taken any exit at that point, because now they say, now we need to talk about who's right and who's wrong. And I'm willing to hear your objections. I hope you'll be willing to hear mine. And in later sessions, we'll talk about some of those things. But you see, obviously, I've got to cut off this other track first. What about the person who says, oh, no, I think truth is relative? They say, well, sure doesn't seem very sensible. We're talking about whether a car is parked outside or not, to say the least. And that's at that point, as I responded to Bob, a sophisticated relativist, or at least a person who has tenacity in his or her relativism, is going to say, yeah, when it comes to objective material things, things you can touch or see or perceive in an empirical fashion, using our senses, I don't believe in relativism. But anything that's beyond, you know, that, I think it's relativistic. Okay? I'm going to surprise you. At that point, I think you ought to say, wait a minute. You've gone way too far. You said that as long as it pertains to the outward physical world, then it isn't relativistic. I want to ask you, why not? If you're going to be a relativist, why don't you go the whole way? I'm going to invite you to be a relativist about everything. The person said, well, no, wait a minute. Everybody can look and see. And if you've done any kind of reflection or advanced study on this matter, you'll know that, matter of fact, perceptions are relative. That's one of the fascinating things. We tend to think that since I see the book on the table, in this case, this book being a blue book that's on the table, that everybody else sees it as blue as well. And so I just think it is objectively the truth. There is a blue tape, there is a blue book on that table, on that square table right there. Okay? That settles it, right? But you see, for me to take it as beyond dispute that there's a blue book on that square table, I have to assume that I'm somehow inside of your head, having your eyeballs and ears and your hands and so forth, that I have all your perceptions, all of your experiences, and I know what they're like, and I can say that they're the same. So what I want you to do at this point is drive the relativist to the wall with this relativism. Say, no, wait a minute. You're taking far too much for granted. You want to say you can know something about the objective world. I want to suggest if you're going to be a relativist, you can't know anything. And when you say, yeah, but everybody can use his eyes to see there's a blue book on the table. You see the blue book, don't you, David? You don't? The pure in heart can see it.
Numbers. I mean, that's where the real record comes.
The pure in heart can see a blue book. Does anybody see a blue book on the table? Okay. Which gray book? What if I'm colorblind? Now, I don't, by the way, I probably need to study up to give you a better illustration. I'm not sure if blue and gray are one of the ones that tend to be blurred, but those who are colorblind. But there are some colors that we distinguish that colorblind people don't distinguish. Let's assume blue and gray, one of them, just for the sake of this illustration. If I'm colorblind, then things are relative, right? The way you see things is not the way I see things. Oh, as far as seeing things, perceptions are different, is what this points to. Whether it's strange operation here, or color blindness, or, as it turns out, just a matter of physical perspective on an object. I'm going to ask you all to tell me what the shape of this object is that I'm holding up. And now, be philosophical, be honest. Guard against saying, I know the answer from past experiences. I've had one of those things in my pocket, too. I know the answer. Don't go to the back of the book. Bob, it doesn't make any difference. That's what I'm trying to tell you. What is the shape of this object? Now, you all look at it and say, well, it's round, correct? What? Bob, are you being antagonistic? What is the shape of this object, Bob? This is a simple question. What is the general shape of this object, Bob? Thank you. Now, looking at it in this way, it is. But I'm going to do something. If you watch, I know it's small. I should have a quarter. I'm not welcome enough to have one of those things. If I do this with the coin, though, what is its shape? Maybe hard for Jim back there, better glasses to tell, but those of you who are up close, what is the shape, David? It's an ellipse now. So now what is this? Is this round or is this elliptical? Oh, and how did you decide that? Let me tell you how you decided it. It's cultural. By the way, and it is. I'm not just being the devil's advocate here. It is cultural because we are brought up pretty much in Western culture, certainly in American, Britain, and so forth. We are brought up to answer questions about shape by taking what, it's not called this popularly, but theoretically it's called the preferred perspective. And the preferred perspective on something, I'm not going to get technical, you might liken it to having something lay flat on a desk with you standing over the desk like this. That's the preferred perspective. And the way you see things in that position, that's their shape. But what if we had a culture of natives where all brought up to say, when they look at things, they always look at them like that. They say, that elliptical dime, sure, I know that. You say, oh no, it's round. Oh no, it's not. Look at it, like that. Why would the natives say that it's elliptical and we say that it's round? We have different perceptions, don't we? Or we have different preferred perspectives on it. Perception's different. Have you ever had the experience of being so sick with a high fever that you're delirious? Maybe hallucinate? If you haven't hallucinated, you might also have had the experience of seeing and feeling things differently when you're sick. Okay? I know people who sometimes when they get a high fever say their hands feel like wood. There's a kind of numbness in their hands or extremities that they liken to being as inanimate, like wood. Okay? Now, should we say that since that's what they experienced, their hand was wood when they were sick? Or wood-like when they were sick? I don't want to take much more time on this. What I'm saying is, when someone tells you, no, I am a relativist when it comes to religion and morality and beauty and things like that, but I'm not a relativist when it comes to things we can perceive, you should say, oh, you're taking far too much for granted. Because the very things that you would offer as reasons for your relativism in religion, that people see it differently, I could offer you as reasons for being a relativist when it comes to your experiences, too. So be consistent. Be honest. Live up to your principles. If your principle is different people have different experiences or beliefs, therefore it's relative, then let's just say everything is relative. Okay, everything's relative. Now we got a third step in our argument. What do you do when the person says, okay, I guess I was taking for granted that we could get by with empirical objectivism, but we have to have kind of a religio-ethical relativism in other areas that are not empirical. We have to be relativistic. But I guess you're right. I'm forced now to say that it's not just beliefs that are relative, it's truth. And it's not just truth about non-empirical things, it's all truth and it's relative. And it's at this point you have to say, you have just contradicted yourself.
What? I've just contradicted myself.
Well, yeah, you just said that everything is relative.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what you forced me to say. Everything is relative.
Well,
is the sentence, everything is relative, relative?
I mean, maybe for you, everything is relative, but for me, nothing is relative. If you're a relativist, isn't that something you have to grant? But you see, if the relativist grants that, what the relativist is saying is, I don't know that I'm right. I don't know that I'm correct. I'm asserting that no one knows for sure, and I don't even know that no one knows for sure. Well, but if you don't know that no one knows for sure, why would you say it? I mean, that just sounds like, you know, gobbledygook. It's just some kind of arbitrary off the wall. And how we know you're not on drugs and you're just babbling now. No one knows for sure. I mean, and nobody does that, by the way. No one just comes to their relativism without reasons. And that's why relativism is always self-contradictory. Relativists have reasons for their relativism. Margaret Mead is a relativist. Margaret Mead's very well-known, retired now, well-known sociologist who did work on the sexual mores of Samoan young girls and really shocked Americans when she suggested that premarital sex is not looked upon as immoral in Samoa, and consequently that question all has to do with one's upbringing and culture. And so people have reasons for asserting relativism. That is to say, they look at the world and they'll say, well, people have different beliefs, therefore everything's relative. But you see, you can't say people have different beliefs, therefore, if you're a relativist. Because if you're a relativist, you don't know what's going on out there. Because there is no out there that I can know objectively. And so the very use of reasons to support relativism undermines the relativism. Now, let me put it to you this way. To be a relativist about fact is to maintain that there is no such thing as objective knowledge. The difficulty here is to eschew the inconsistent claim that the relativistic thesis is itself an item of objective knowledge. The relativist is relativistic about everything except what? The thesis of relativism, which is universally and absolutely true. And if it isn't, then we've won apologetically. You see, if the relativist says, I can't support this, and if you challenge him, prove your relativism, he says, I can't. Do you think it's true? No, I'm a relativist, I can't believe anything's true. I say, okay, fine, let's carry on our conversation then, since you don't even think that relativism is true. you just cannot carry out relativism consistently. The relativist is contradicting himself when he asserts his relativism. Is there anybody who has not caught that, Jim?
Yeah. If he says, "I believe," then everything is relative. And that's certainly true for everyone. I believe that's the case. The fact that we're able to talk about charity on that is a lot of things. Have a similar belief. It's close enough to assume the word. It is a belief in mind.
Can you prove it to yourself?
I either have to have faith that everything's real, or I have to have faith that it's relative, and I've chosen on the basis of my experience that it's relative. And people react in the same way.
Is it true that you believe that everything's relative? Or do you only believe that you believe that everything's relative? Now, I want you to see something here about this. One, in my response, I saw some of you smile when I said it. You see what the point is? You cannot talk if you're a relativist. Even to say, "I'm a relativist about my relativism," you can ask, "Is that true? Are you really a relativist about your relativism?" The relativist ends up asserting something, even if it's only about himself. But if Jim responds in this way, or if the hypothetical unbeliever responds in this way, then you need to be aware of the fact that there are people who are so stubborn or tenacious or hard-hearted that they will say, "Okay, I guess I only believe that I believe that I'm a relativist." And do you believe that you believe that you believe that you're a relativist? And this can go on and on and on. Let's stop it there because it... You see the point. You can keep saying, "Now, do you believe that? And do you believe that?" You have all these tiers of beliefs about yourself. At that juncture, however, I want to suggest that perhaps the best thing is just to tell the fellow, "Well, then speak up and let everybody know this." You see, if you don't even know what you believe, and you only believe that you believe that all things are relative, then what I want to suggest is, though you're going to be tenacious enough to hold on to that, I want everybody else in the room, or in the class, or in the universe, I want everybody else to know that the choice then is between the pathetic situation of not even knowing your own beliefs and Christianity. I want them to know that if you're going to be rational about your approach to life, you have to be a Christian. Now, why am I taking that approach? Because I want you to remember that apologetics is not geared to making people cry uncle. And that's where we get off the track. We tend to think, if I can't get this guy to say, "All right, you're right and I'm wrong," we haven't won. Oh no, if you dance him into the corner where he says, "I don't even know what I believe," I think you've done a marvelous job apologetically. You see, because it's the objective vindication of the faith. He may not ever give in. But my guess is, if you stop pushing him at that point and say, "Oh fine, that's exactly what I wanted you to say. Look how foolish your unbelief is," you'll probably get him a little unhappy with where he ended up. But there's only one way out of that, and that's to get out into the objective realm of debating the truth of things and not being a relativist anymore. Okay? Go ahead.
I
want
to go. Because I've taken people to that point, and I think Eastern religions have had a lot to do with relativism because of the fact that they're basically built on contradiction, and you know, self-admittedly they are contradictory.
Right.
And I've had people fall back into that and say, "Well, it doesn't matter anyway, because you know, why do things have to be consistent, or why do things have to, you know, why does it have to be a law of non-contradiction for me to, you know, get through life?" And you know, you can even defeat them there, but still they just fall back into that. You know, then,
yeah, the old, you see, but what that is saying is, we're not talking about one of these mediating Hindus, you see, that gets caught in these contradictions and worries about that. We're talking about the guy who's going to swallow the whole enchilada, right? He says, "That's right, I'm contradicting myself, I'm an utter fool. I'm an irrationalist. I couldn't possibly defend anything that I've said." And I'd say, "And you can't even possibly understand it either, because you're contradicting yourself. So you're not even sure what you're..." "That's right, I'm not even sure what I'm saying, but I know that it's true? See, it's right there. You see, when I talk to these people in airports, you know, we sit down and they want to sell their Bhagavad Gitas and so forth. So I was interested. I never let on that I'm in ministry, you know. Let's just play this out. Let's see where this goes, okay? And they get to this point where they're contradicting themselves. And I have had on a couple of occasions say, yes, but contradiction is, you know, isn't that the beauty of the truth that, you know, there's a contradiction, all that. And I'm like, oh, gosh. I say, now, is it true that these two contradictory premises express the ultimate truth? Yeah. Well, then it's false that that expresses the ultimate truth. Uh-uh, it's true. I said, wait a minute. If the law of non-contradiction is unimportant, everything you affirm I can deny, and we're both right. You see, you cannot hold to a religion, even a religion of irrationalism, and say, that's right, it's false. That is affirming contradiction as something that's good and wonderful, you can ask them, is it true that it's good and wonderful? Are you saying that your religion's true or your religion's false? Well, you know, the only way out is to say it's neither. There is no truth. But you see, when somebody tells me there is no truth, then I can respond, then why should I believe what you're saying? As a matter of fact, I won't buy a Bhagavad Gita today because you don't even have, you see, the wherewithal to tell me it's true. The fact that you think it's true wouldn't make it true, but you don't even think it's true, so why should I buy a Bhagavad Gita? And at this point, you have to say, okay, the problem was they tried to be missionaries. If you're a missionary, you can't be a relativist. But what about contradictory religions that do not have the missionary spirit about them? Religions that glory in contradiction and don't care if anybody believes them or not. You know, this may sound cynical. You know my word is about that? Fine. Because give them a few decades and they'll be gone. If you don't have the missionary spirit and you contradict yourself, you're not going to get anybody that continues to believe this stuff. In the end, relativism may be a nice mental game to play with. No one can live this way. And that's why if you carry on the conversation, the very aspect of living, carrying on the conversation, is going to force the person to betray his or her relativism. Now, I want to take another form of relativism, more particularly ethical relativism, and talk about it before our time is up this evening. In our culture in particular, the idea that what is right and wrong is person-relative has a lot of advocates, even when people will say, well, we can't say truth is relative, but we can say morality is relative. So I want to say a little bit about that before you go. Why do people say that? Well, it goes something like this. I'll use Margaret Mead as my illustration. Margaret Mead goes out, she studies the Samoan Islands. She comes back and she says, as a matter of objective, descriptive fact, the Samoan people do not share American uptightness about premarital sex. Therefore, there is no objective right and wrong. It's all relative depending upon your culture. And now, I told you, the first step of the relativist is to say, oh, wait a minute, Margaret. Are you saying, therefore, the Samoans don't believe what the Americans believe? Is that what you're saying? In which case, that's rather trivial. Okay? That's fine, but big deal. One's right, one's wrong, or they're both wrong, but you can't say both are right. That's the problem. Margaret Mead wanted to say, for Americans, it was right. For Samoans, it was wrong. I mean, for Samoans, it was right to think premarital sex is acceptable. For Americans, it was right to say it wasn't acceptable. They contradict each other in their attitudes, and both are right. Both are correct. And the reason that a person would assert that, the reason she did and others like her asserted, is because we have seen that people come to different answers on the question of premarital sex. Since there are different answers, therefore, ethics is relative. I'm going to ask you a question. It's my class tonight. And if you have to answer within 10 seconds. What is 4,093 times 211? Nine, 10. That's it. Now we're going to get your answers. Now, if we went around the room and you actually gave an answer, you all made the effort to do this. Some of you real quickly tried to do your calculator. Some did it in your head. Some did it on paper. You know, maybe we've got a bunch of geniuses here, and it wouldn't be a good illustration. I'd have to come up with another. My guess is we're going to have a variety of answers. Right? And that's probably what's going to happen. When you're forced to do a long multiplication problem, 10 seconds like that, and you have to give an answer, I'm going to get you're not, it's going to be really a miracle, I think, if you all come up with the same right or wrong answer, something like that. Now, assuming we all did that, and I got your answers back, what if I were to say, I see you come up with different answers to this mathematical problem. Therefore, I believe in mathematical relativism. I think there is no objective truth to math. I think it's all relative. Now, in that area, you wouldn't put up with that for a minute. You'd all jump in there with both feet and say, well, you fooled. You fooled. That doesn't mean that math is relativism. It means we didn't do our work correctly. We didn't study long enough. We didn't have time to check our answers. You see what I'm saying there? Why don't you say that to Margaret Mead? Why don't you say, Margaret, you fool? It doesn't prove that everything's relative. It just proves that somebody hasn't done his homework. Someone hasn't checked his answers. We haven't studied this long enough. That people come to different answers doesn't prove relativism. It just proves that some people make mistakes. Now, which is the more reasonable? When we're talking about math, you'd say it's utterly unreasonable to say, well, everything's relative in math because, you know, I gave this homework problem and six of my students came up with different answers, so I guess it's relative. The whole education process is predicated on what? Showing those six students how to come to the right answer in common. It's just because we believe in the objective validity and truth of math that we make students go and redo their homework. Now, I have an answer to my question, but the rhetorical question is, why don't we do that with the Samoans? Why don't we say, go home and do your homework? You haven't seen this correctly. You haven't come to your ethical conclusions in an accurate way. You need to listen to God. You need to open the Bible. You need to say, that's the only way to do ethics. And I say, that's rhetorical. Since in math we tell the student, go home and correct his homework, I could respond to the sociologist, yes, and tell these people to do their homework better. They're mistaken. I agree, they believe this, but they are wrong in what they believe. But now what's the answer rhetorically? Because to say that is to do something which is important in democratic Western culture, and that's to say, I'm better than you. I'm right, and you're wrong. That is, I think, really the gut-level strength of relativism, is that you never put in that self-righteous position of saying, I'm right, you're wrong. People do not like that in our day and age. It was not always like that, and very relativistic, isn't it? There have been cultures where you were supposed to feel strongly about these convictions and defend them. But that is in our day and age. I've found that it's very out of place, and sadly, very out of place in the church, too. I mean, it's socially out of place. It's the right thing. But in the church, if you say, well, we're right and they're wrong, we love them, we can learn from them in some things, but on this point they are wrong, people will still say, well then, boy, you are proud, aren't you? You're arrogant, aren't you? That is, this relativism has swept the spirit of our country. The zeitgeist of our culture is relativistic, the spirit of our day. And that's why we don't answer in religion the way we might immediately answer in math. If somebody came with a different answer in math, we'd say, look, you made a mistake, go do your homework, correct it. But we don't say that in religion. We don't say it immediately because that makes us sound superior. And so the final thing I want to tell you about relativism tonight is, if you want to effectively answer the relativist, then the quality of your life is going to have to be persuasive. Because in the end, it's not an intellectual matter. In the end, it's not like you can defend. Some people try, but I'm not talking about the very sophisticated, high-level hothouse environment of relativism that I see at the philosophy department at SC, for instance. Your garden variety relativist is pretty much governed by this feeling that nobody has the right to be so superior as to think they're right and others are wrong. Now, you are going to have to do that. Either that or you're going to have to give up Christianity, because as Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And no man comes to the Father but by me. It's not relative. It's not diverse. It's not different strokes for different folks. There's only one way. I am the truth, Jesus said. And anyone who doesn't agree with me is wrong. And even worse, anyone who doesn't agree with me is not only wrong, they're going to hell. That is what you're going to have to defend winsomely, cordially, politely. But you're going to have to defend that point of view. And to do so, I think you need to pay attention to the quality of your life. Now, even if your life is pristine, pure in all matters, you're still going to have people who don't like this assertion of superiority. But my point is, if you're going to have any hearing at all, you're going to have to be in a position where somebody doesn't say, oh, you think there are these absolutes. Why don't you live like that then? How is it I see you cutting corners here? Why do I find you compromising here or there? Why aren't you everything that you're supposed to be if you're so self-righteous and so absolutely right and so superior to the rest of us? Now again, you didn't say, I'm righteous, I'm superior. But if you assert truth over against error, that's the way you're going to be taken. And I'm saying, to get a hearing, you need to make sure that your life does have some power to it. There's got to be a display of righteousness and godliness so that people will say, even if they're irked by being proven wrong, they say, well, I guess if anyone has the right to say that sort of thing, he or she does. Look at the way they live. Okay? No, that's true. Persecution is inevitable. And I'm not trying to say that there's some technique or ritual we can go through that's going to avoid that. What I am saying, though, is that you're talking to your next-door neighbor, your milkman, or what have you. If they know, if they have something that attracts them about your life, about your genuine concern for the poor or the needy, or that you're really a person of prayer, that you do show integrity, or that you have an even spirit, you're not a hothead, or whatever it may be, if there's something that communicates genuineness about your commitment, that will at least keep them from immediately writing you off as like another one of those self-righteous people. Some people are going to be persuaded by the quality of our life and not just by our words.
Would you really affect me?
Let's take that, not Julie, but that kind of thing as an illustration. I would say that's true of me, too. I've had times where the bad response I've had from a hearer has been a combination of the hearer's sinful dislike of the truth, and then also the fact that I haven't worked on my technique enough to not be abrasive, let's say. So that what I'm suggesting at the end of our lesson is, let's work on, if abrasiveness is what makes the person not willing to hear a morally superior point of view from us, let's work on the abrasiveness. So that when all is said and done, people are without any excuse for responding negatively to our assertion of absolute truth and moral absolutes. What's that?
Well, other than their excuses, they're sinful.
No, no, that's not an excuse, though. What I'm saying is, instead of leaving them with a little bit to say, yeah, well, how can you assert some kind of absolute? I see you compromise, too. As best we can, let's have lives that communicate the truth as well as words that communicate the truth. If you want to be successful, I can't give you an automatic formula. But if you want to improve your likelihood of success, I would suggest this is an important thing to reflect on. So relativism, that's the biggest one you're going to face, and if this helps you, what are the three steps? Do you have them in your notes? First thing, give the person a chance to say, oh, what I mean is everyone believes different things. And a lot of people will fall right into that, and if so, give up the relativism defense and get right onto the issue then. Say, okay, you don't believe.